Hi, good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. We're going to get started. I'm Steve Morrison. I direct the Africa program and the CSIS Task Force on HIV/AIDS, which is the latter is sponsoring this, particularly the prevention committee, which is headed by Jen Cates and Phil Nyberg, who in a moment will introduce our speaker today, David Gutnick from GAO. David, just personally, thank you very much for agreeing to do this. You know, this is a really big issue, and Jen and Phil can explain in their introductory remarks why it's so important to the work that we do and why it's so important as a matter of U.S. Policy and approaches on HIV/AIDS. We are busy on this issue. We're going to be having a major gathering up in the Senate July 13th, looking at some of the large issues that Congress needs to revisit as it gets towards the conclusion of the first five-year phase, and this is certainly one of the short list. And this helps us a lot, David. I think the work you've done in taking this on and being very methodical and systematic in trying to canvass opinion and discern what the sources of confusion and ambiguity are and what the roots are. And those roots bring us back to Congress, which is really the fundamental to this, and gets us back to how is Congress going to understand and act in the future on these problematic aspects that everyone struggles with. So thank you all for coming. I think this is a very big moment on this debate. David, I think you've done some remarkable work, and we're all indebted to you for doing that work. I'm going to ask Jen and Phil to do the introductions for the panel.
Thanks, Steve. I'm Phil Nyberg, Senior Associate at CSIS, and with Jen Cates next to me, co-chair of the Working Committee on Prevention of this task force. And I'm going to say a few words about the committee and then have Jen talk about today's session. The Working Committee on Prevention was formed a couple of years ago because of a concern at that point, and still continuing, that HIV prevention is at risk, and that a number of indicators point to an insufficient amount of attention to prevention. One is that funding in the HIV/AIDS world, funding is heavily toward treatment. There's been an ideologic gridlock around discussions of many of the important prevention issues. There are lots of misconceptions about what prevention is and how it ought to work in the HIV world, and that attention has largely shifted to treatment access. So to address some of these issues, we thought of and have been convening this forum, the Working Committee on Prevention, to raise issues and have public discussion in an independent, neutral, nonpartisan, bipartisan way about complex issues. And as I mentioned, this is intended. The work of this working committee is intended to be nonpartisan and to provide. These sessions are intended to provide space for objective public discussion. Participation in this committee, in the work of this committee, has been participation on the part of people from Congress, the administration, HIV prevention scientists, foreign policy experts, and members of NGOs, including faith-based organizations. This session today is one of a series that we've started, and actually, for those of you who got a copy of the handout, they're listed on the ones that have already occurred and that are being discussed for the future are listed on the second page. The ones that we've had already are substitution therapy for injection drug use, convened in the middle of last year, the ABC guidance of PEPFAR in December of last year. This is the third. This session is the third in the series. One other is currently scheduled. That is a discussion about the ongoing research and potential of male circumcision as an HIV prevention intervention. That's scheduled for the afternoon of May 9th. In addition to the sessions, a number of papers have been produced, one on funding for prevention, one on second wave countries, and one on prevention indicators. And for each of these, Jen actually has been the primary author. But there's been input from a lot of other people. With that, I'll turn it over to Jen to talk about the beginning of today's session.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to a session when it's so nice outside. We had one request to hold this session actually outside. Just to talk a little bit about this session today and pick up from where Phil left off, the work of the committee and the way we've approached it, very much the way CSIS Task Force has been organized, is to say that there are a lot of challenging issues facing the U.S. government and its partners in implementing arguably the largest global HIV/AIDS initiative in the world. And these are tough issues. Some of them are ideologically tough. Some of them are methodologically tough and practically tough. And what we've hoped in this committee, in this forum, is to address all of those complexities around prevention by providing an opportunity for these kinds of discussions. We knew about the GAO report, I believe, right as it was getting started. We knew that several members of Congress, and I think that was a very interesting point. We'll hear this from David. Several members of Congress from different perspectives had gone to GAO to request some kind of study on prevention specifically. We began talking with GAO at that time, knowing that that would be an important report to allow for discussion. And in fact, the timing of it is really critical, and it's one of, I think it's the first of a series of reports that a lot of people are expecting to come out and be timely and help us all figure out what are the best ways to move forward. There have been other GAO reports, but they've been earlier on in the implementation of PEPFAR. So this really is one of the first ones. The IOM is also engaging in a very, very big evaluation. A couple other things that I wanted to pick up on that both Phil and Steve said. One is the independent and objective nature of these discussions that we've really tried amidst all of the sometimes noise out there on some of these issues to try to provide a forum where we can engage in on these difficult questions. We've had very good success with that in some of the other sessions. We had a good session on substitution therapy for injection drug users, and it was before the guidance came out, which has recently been released, and I think it allowed for a really good dialogue about information that actually hopefully got into the guidance a little bit. We had a session on the ABC guidance, and I think this picks up from that. Finally, one thing about the work of the task force in this year and the work of our committee is that everything we're doing really has an eye towards reauthorization of PEPFAR and future of PEPFAR. So what are some of the key questions that could potentially be addressed by Congress or by the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator in its guidance that can just, based on what we're learning and what the office is learning in the field, that can improve things going forward? With that, I'm going to introduce our speaker and presenter today and the author, main author of this research study that we're going to hear about, Dr. David Gutnick from GAO. He's been the Director of International Affairs and Trade at the GAO since 2001. In addition to global health, his portfolio includes humanitarian aid, development assistance, and economic assistance. And from 1994 to 2001, he was the director of the Office of Medical Services at the Peace Corps. And prior to that, he was a practicing physician and director of the University Health Services at New York University. So thank you, David, again, for being with us today.
Thank you, Jen. And thank you to CSIS for hosting us. Very happy to be here today to discuss our recent report. It is a great opportunity for us to have this forum to speak to the findings of our report and to be privileged to be a part of and to hear the discussion that may ensue. Let me acknowledge first two members of my staff, one of whom is here and one of whom is not. Celia Thomas is the assistant director on this engagement, and we have worked closely together on this for the better part of a year. Elizabeth Singer, who I think many of you may know from this work, is at home, very pregnant and on bed rest. So if you're watching on the camera, Elizabeth, stay in bed, listen to your doctor, and we wish you well. I am going to spend just a few minutes on this report. I will stick very closely, I think, to the findings of the report, perhaps in true GAO fashion, fastidiously closely to the findings in this report, and hope that that stimulates some discussion as we go forward. I think I have perhaps 20 minutes where I will brief introduction, look at the study objectives and methodology, discuss a little bit of the background on this report, go through the key findings and the recommendations, and have a couple of select technical issues that are in annexes to our report that we may touch on briefly. Just very briefly by way of background, as I think most people know, GAO is an independent, nonpartisan agency that performs a whole range of activities in support of Congress, but in particular, and in this case, a performance audit that we cover the waterfront of government expenditures. Celia and I represent the International Affairs and Trade Group, and so we focus on a range of 150 account and other activities. GAO primarily does its work in response to congressional request or to mandate directives written into various bills. In the case of this report, we had two letters, as was alluded to, Chairman Hyde from the House International Relations Committee and Mr. Waxman, ranking member on House Government Reform. Those two letters each came in December of 2004. They were both focused on this issue, the broad issue of prevention programs funded under PEPFAR. They clearly had two very different perspectives and asked some very different questions. In those circumstances and based on that broad base of interest, the Comptroller General has the authority to take these requests, bring them in-house, and do them on his own authority. We elected to do that in this case because we thought that it would allow us to answer these questions in the most objective and in the most timely fashion. We did this work between February of 2005 and February of 2006. We issued the report on April 4th. It's worth some note, we have done prior work, as was alluded to, in the HIV-AIDS area. We did a prior report on PEPFAR, the ramping up of the treatment limb, just on 2 years ago, where, as we'll see, we used a very similar methodology to the core methodology we employed for this report. Let me hit a bottom line and then spend most of the rest of my time discussing the report and coming back to the bottom line. The key message in our report, I think, is that while the Leadership Act has significantly increased the resources, the U.S. commitment to fight HIV/AIDS, that, and while OGAC has done a tremendous number of things correctly and right and well, and I hope we hit on a lot of them during this session, that the Act's AB earmark, the AB spending requirement, has, particularly as viewed by the U.S. government implementers in the field, presented challenges to integrating components of the ABC model and to responding to local needs. That is the core, by no means the only finding, but a key finding in our report, and it is the one that tees up our recommendations. Our recommendations, I think, framed rather, again, in GAO fashion, in a rather circumspect manner, recommend that OGAC collect and report to Congress ongoing information from the country teams about the spending requirement's effect and that that information be used by OGAC to consider its application of the spending requirement. We'll talk about how it's applied. And by Congress to assess the extent to which this spending requirement supports Congress's twin policy objectives as articulated in the bill. On the one hand, to endorse and promote the ABC model of HIV prevention, and on the other hand, to endorse and promote a strong abstinence programming. These are the three objectives of the report, just very briefly. The first two are quite descriptive. We review the trends and allocation of PEPFAR funding. And secondly, we describe the PEPFAR strategy. I think both of these are familiar to many here, and I'll touch on them briefly. Thirdly, in a more analytic way, we examine the key challenges associated with applying the PEPFAR strategy for prevention of sexual transmission of HIV/AIDS. A word about the methodology that we employed. And as I mentioned, we did employ a similar methodology on the treatment limb in a report we issued 2 years ago. A key element of our methodology was to look, and as I mentioned, to try to assay in a clear and candid way the views of the U.S. implementers, the country teams, in each of the focus countries, and indeed in five additional countries that I'll touch on briefly. We do this in part through structured interviews. We developed a structured interview tool that asked open-ended questions, that was pre-tested, that covered a range of topics that were vetted broadly, and we analyzed that through a variety of means that employed methodologists, that categorized independently the findings, and that tallied our results. In addition to that, we reviewed country operational plans. The Office of Global AIDS Coordinator, I should say, was very supportive of the work that we did. They provided us access to documents that helped us do this work, and for that we're very grateful. Nobody's particularly thrilled when GAO comes to town, and I will say that OGAC responded to this work with a real sense of partnership. We also looked closely at the request for exemptions from the spending requirement. As we'll get to in a moment, as I think people know, the spending requirement within the prevention budget was established in 2006, and thus for the first time, exemptions to the spending requirement were put forward. I'll discuss that at some length. Just very briefly, I think, again, people are familiar with this. If you look at the Leadership Act, it specifies percentages for PEPFAR program areas. It requires 55% of the funds be spent on treatment and that 10% be spent on orphans and vulnerable children. It recommends, as a sense of Congress, that 20% of the PEPFAR funds be spent on prevention. Within that prevention 20%, it further goes on to identify the requirement of funding being put forward for the abstinence until marriage spending requirement. Let me say a few words about that. The graphic here, the schematic, are the five prevention PEPFAR prevention program areas that were articulated by the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator early on in June of 2004. Basically, the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator divided prevention into five program areas, two of which are sexual prevention and three of which are non-sexual prevention. Abstinence faithfulness being in the upper left-hand corner, and other prevention activities being the two components of prevention that are related to the prevention of sexual transmission. Other prevention activities is analogous to the C in the ABC approach, but it is not a one-to-one relationship. Other prevention includes certainly the C of correcting consistent use of condoms for high-risk populations. It also includes management of sexually transmitted diseases. It includes program areas that focus on reduction of injection drug use and a number of other categories. So those are the two sexual prevention areas. Prevention of mother-to-child transmission, safe medical injections, and blood safety fall into the non-sexual. And the leadership bill reserves 33% of the funding for abstinence until marriage programs defined by the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator and notified to Congress as A and B in the ABC model. Voluntary counseling and testing is actually under the care limb of in the PEPFAR program's counting of funding sources. Very descriptively and quickly, these are the funding for prevention over the course of the first 3 years of the PEPFAR program. You can see that in 2004, roughly $207 million went to prevention. It went up roughly 40% in 2005 to $294 million, and up another 10% to $322 million. This is for the 15 focus countries in 2006. The blue boxes represent the central funding, and the maroon boxes represent country-level funding. The central funding, what previously had been referred to as Track 1, is now, I think, perhaps more easily understood as central funding for prevention. Worthy of note, the vast majority of blood safety and safe medical injections are funded centrally, so a good bit of the blue boxes come out of those two areas. Approximately 21% of the AB funding is awarded centrally, and the remainder is country level. This is just a look at how the share of PEPFAR funding dedicated to prevention has played out over the 3 years. You can see that initially, early in the life of the program, roughly one-third, that's 33% of the funding of the PEPFAR funding went to prevention in 2004. It declined over the next 2 years, largely in an effort to achieve the 20% sense of Congress, but also with a recognition that treatment programs were ramping up, and so there was somewhat of an inverse relationship. I want to note for the purposes of this slide and for the rest of our presentation that for 06 funding, we are working with planned funding as established on March 15th, essentially at the time we went to press. 04 and 05 funding are basically obligated dollars in OGAC's database. 06 is funding that was planned as of the point in time we went to press. We had a good conversation with OGAC about that, about the nature of those numbers, and I think we were confident, as was OGAC, that those numbers fairly represent the direction of the 06 program, but I think there will be some minor tweaks along the way as they finalize their dollars for 06. This is a quick look at the breakdown of funding by the five prevention areas, and what you can see is that between 04 and 05, funding went up for all five of the prevention areas. The top blue line with the diamond is the AB programs. The red line is other prevention. The green line is prevention of mother-to-child transmission, and the bottom two lines are blood safety and safe medical injections. What you can see is that between 04 and 05, sort of a rising tide lifts all boats, all of the programs went up to some degree. Between 05 and 06, where the total funding went up about 10%, there was more variability as to which programs went up, but that the abstinence and faithfulness, the AB programs, went from roughly $76 million to roughly $108 million between 05 and 06. Our second objective was simply to lay out the PEPFAR strategy for prevention of sexual transmission of HIV. Fairly straightforward. We tried to do that in a clear, concise, and easily understood way. I think many people in this audience are going to be familiar with the approach, but the PEPFAR strategy really revolves around these three principles. Number one, the ABC model. Number two, the abstinence until marriage spending requirement. And number three, country team strategies for responding to the local needs. Let me say a little bit about each of them and then try to move quickly on. Both the ABC model and the abstinence until marriage spending requirement, I think it's important to think of as having a leadership bill component and having an OGAC policies and guidance component. So that with respect to the ABC model, the leadership bill spells out ABC in that order of priority, A first, then B, then C. It also cites the Uganda model at some length as the source and the basis for Congress's policy determination that the ABC model was a congressional priority. The Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator took that notion from the leadership bill and established a set of rules and some guidance around building programs consistent with the ABC model that we'll talk about in a moment. Likewise, the abstinence until marriage spending requirement, as we've seen, emanates from the 33% spending requirement as established in the bill. The Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator went on to establish a few basically policies which allowed them to get to that 33% spending requirement. In particular, they looked at it on a country-by-country basis in order to build to the global 33%. They allowed countries to request exemptions from their spending requirement on a case-by-case basis. They tried to set parameters for which countries could request waivers or exemptions. By virtue of the math, they discouraged the largest programs from requesting exemptions, and they established some guidance that in settings of a generalized epidemic, they hoped to minimize the request for exemptions or waivers. In addition, while this is the source of a considerable amount of confusion, they established two other policies that allowed them to get to the 33% requirement and further clarified in their context. Number one, they established an expectation that each post would spend at least 50% of its global prevention budget on the prevention of the sexual transmission. So A, B, and other prevention were to receive 50% of the funds, and that within that, there would be a 2-to-1 ratio, that two-thirds of the sexual prevention would go to abstinence faithfulness programs and one-third would go to other prevention. So they established a little bit of a 2-to-1 ratio that in some ways yoked those two subsets of the prevention dollar together. And then finally, as I think is well understood, country teams were asked to build programs based on their own local circumstances, their local epidemiology, and submit them to the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator for review and approval. Almost home, these are three key findings that look at the challenges associated with implementing the prevention strategy, the strategy to prevent the sexual transmission of HIV/AIDS. The first challenge is related to the guidance in implementation of the ABC model. And I should say that the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator has put a lot of attention, a lot of work into this, and I think has done a very credible job in building a set of guidance that take the ABC model in the leadership bill and translate it into a set of guidance and in some fashion a set of rules that allow the country teams to build their programs. The key principles that they lay out are things I think are widely understood and supported. The model should be applied in accordance with local prevention needs, should be integrated, should be coordinated with host government strategic planning, should be driven by best practices, on the one hand. On the other hand, there was a set of rules that were built that really created, for lack of a better term, a matrix between those populations that were being served, and those populations were stratified by age, 10 to 14, youths above 14, and non-youths, by whether or not the intervention in question was taking place in a school or outside of a school setting, by whether or not the population reached was engaged in risk-based activities or not, so some population-based parameters, and then some activity-based parameters. So whether the program would be AB only, whether it be an integrated ABC program, within an integrated ABC program where C activities were permissible, would condoms be distributed? Would condoms be promoted? Would condoms be marketed? Would condoms be seen as the primary basis for prevention of sexual transmission of HIV/AIDS? OGAC, I think, made a good faith effort to build a matrix of populations served and programs that supported Congress's priorities on A first, then B, and then C. Our first finding was that that effort to build that set of rules did cause some confusion, and that we cite in 10 of the 15 focus countries, while there was a great deal of support for the guidance that was put forward, there was some confusion about how to apply those rules that built that matrix of population and interventions. Our second finding: the spending requirement can limit efforts to design programs that are integrated and responsive to local needs. And again, this came out of our structured interview, requests for exemptions, and country operational plans that we reviewed. Again, country teams valued the ABC model. I think if one were to fairly represent the structured interview and the other data that we evaluated, there was a great deal of support for the efforts put forward by OGAC, and a great deal of enthusiasm for the new resources that were being put towards this problem, but that in a variety of ways, meeting the spending requirement challenged their ability to be responsive to the third core principle, building programs that are responsive to local needs and that are integrated A from B from C. 8 of 15 focus countries specified in our structured interview that the requirement can undermine program integration, and 17 of 20 teams, and that additional 5 is when we brought in the request for waivers and the waiver discussion, we were able to review material from 5 additional teams, Russia, India, Cambodia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi, which are the five teams that receive over $10 million in OGAC funds and thus were asked to adhere to the spending requirements. When we looked at those 20 teams, 17 of them reported challenges to being responsive to local needs. Our final finding relates to the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator's application of the spending requirement to funding accounts beyond the Global HIV/AIDS Initiative. The Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator determined that as a matter of law, the requirement of the 33% spending requirement applied to the GHAI spending account that was established in the leadership bill. They also determined that as a matter of policy, they would fold under the one-third requirement some certain CDC funds, some child survival health account funds, and a very limited amount of FSU dollars in the former Soviet Union, and pull those into the spending requirement. That was a relatively small pot of money. We cited as $35 million in FY 2006, and that indeed for the focus countries it represented a very small percentage of their budget, roughly 2%. But for those five non-focus countries that I identified, it actually represents 82% of their planned FY 06 spending. We had encouraged the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator to consider whether or not they would apply the funding as a matter of policy in the way they understood it as a matter of law. In our agency comments, we worked closely with them to better understand their concerns. They, I think, fairly recognized that from their standpoint, carving the accounts out may undermine their efforts to integrate programs. And so ultimately, we took that observation and folded it under our core recommendation. Our recommendation is that the Secretary of State direct the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator, again, to collect and report to Congress information on the country teams, from the country teams on the spending requirements effect on their prevention program, that they use this information amongst other things, and this is the GHAI, non-GHAI question, amongst other things to consider whether the spending requirement should be applied to all prevention fundings or more narrowly focused on the GHAI account. And we also recommended or suggested to Congress that it should consider this information as provided by OGAC to determine the extent to which Congress's twin priorities, promotion of the ABC model, endorsement of strong abstinence programs, are best served by the earmark. I think that recommendation was framed with an abundance of GAO-style caution and restraint, but that is the sum and substance of our key findings and recommendations. I think I've perhaps more than exhausted my time. I have two technical issues which I think I'll hold for the moment. We do in our technical annexes speak about the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator's PEPFAR's efforts to count results under the prevention program, and we do speak to some issues that relate to limitations on data in counting AB, other prevention, and some of the other prevention programs that allowed us to feel confident that the data was sufficiently reliable for our purposes, but probably better viewed as trend data rather than absolute numbers that you'd want to go to the bank on. With that, let me complete my comments. Appreciate your attention and look forward to ensuing discussion.
Thanks, David. So now we actually are opening up this discussion to include anyone here who has comments they'd like to make or things they'd like to say. And David has said, and his staff are here as well to answer. But I think what we should look at this opportunity as a broader discussion of what the findings might mean and moving forward, what the issues are. Did you? Alan?
Shall I come up here and just...
I think there's... And just say who you are. You have a whole...
There we go. I was working for Senator Frist at the time of that this legislation was passed, and thought it might be useful to talk a little bit about what was going on in the Senate and in the Congress at that time. Before I do that, though, let me commend the team from GAO for an enormous amount of work. I think it's very helpful and very helpful to the ongoing process. A couple of comments on the findings. It'll be interesting to see what we all saw in it, because there were expectations about what we might find, and then there was the report itself. For me, I was not actually surprised that the GAO found some distortions, what I'll call distortions, in spending decisions, priority programs that were unfunded because of the set-aside requirement. That obviously has been a major concern of everybody, including people in the Congress at the time the legislation was passed. But I was also struck in looking at the report that the number of distortions were not nearly as extensive as I think a lot of people were expecting, and I was interested that the report does not push those distortions to the front. It doesn't use them, in my judgment, to make an aggressive push on change for OGAC. It talks about OGAC collecting more data. And I was also interested that the recommendation to Congress was, I would say, soft. That is, it doesn't say you need to change the law or modify the law. It says you need to look at this new data that OGAC will collect and consider whether the program is working the way you think it should. Now, what I conclude from what I will call soft recommendations is that the problems out there aren't all that bad. Now, I don't, you'll have to help me in whether I'm correct in assuming that. I'm a little concerned about the quality of the data. There are some comments in the report about difficulties in the data and how that is a problem, that some of the spending for prevention, for abstinence, for example, one year to the next may reflect programmatic change or may reflect changes in the way data is collected. That's a very important question. Now, if the problems aren't that great, in some ways, I see that as what I might call a lucky accident that I think results from two things. A new understanding or an acknowledged understanding in the field that the ABC type model actually that emphasizes behavioral change is actually working and making a difference. And that may seem obvious now, but it was not always obvious. And there were plenty of people who thought that was a very bad idea just as a concept early on. I think it also is reflective of the fact that OGAC, in an acknowledged but I would say underappreciated maneuver, not necessarily by these folks, but it's worth mentioning, was able to redefine abstinence until marriage, which, if you think about it, is really a subset of abstinence taken literally. It was able to work quietly with the Congress to newly define abstinence until marriage as abstinence writ large plus being faithful. That was a very big deal. A very big deal when you then set about trying to figure out how to reach the 33% requirement. I mean, imagine if we were talking literally about abstinence until marriage and trying to expand that really narrow concept into one-third of all prevention funding or two-thirds of the sexual transmission prevention funding. It would never have worked. I was a little sorry that there wasn't more discussion in the report about the impact of the earmark for blood safety and safer injections, because that consumes a fair chunk of money that messes up all this arithmetic. And that's something that I think going forward we need to look at and try to decide whether that number is the right number and what its impact is on an earmark should earmarks continue. Now, let me also say that I was a little sorry in the administration's comments that they passed on seemed to me a good opportunity to acknowledge, if you will, the benefits of more flexibility on prevention spending. Whether there are lots of distortions or some distortions in actual spending decisions, it's clear that the set-aside requires OGAC and the countries to jump through a bunch of hoops to meet what is, let's acknowledge, a rather arbitrary target that was set with almost no debate in just one house of Congress back when. The concerns about compliance here in Washington, which are legitimate and real, translate to the field to a whole host of challenges, decisions, and that can be a problem and is something that we really need to acknowledge. Let's go back to what was going on in the Senate at the time the bill passed. Leading up to the bill, I'm going to go back to the year 2001. Perhaps most significant that year was a budget resolution amendment that passed, Senator Frist's amendment that would allow room in the budget for a doubling over 2 years of spending on AIDS. And in 2001, we were spending at the rate of about $460 million. His amendment would have allowed room for growth to $1 billion over a two-year time frame. The following year, in 2002, Senators Kerry and Frist introduced their AIDS bill, which really became the template for what became the Leadership Act. In the fall of 2002, Jesse Helms wrote his famous op-ed, the Mea Culpa op-ed, in the Washington Post, where he called rather dramatically for the $500 million PMTCT initiative, along with Senator Frist, that actually was passed and funded. The president embraced it, and that became later folded into to PEPFAR. The president announced his initiative the following State of the Union in 2003, and the House passed its bill May 1st, and the Senate followed within about 2 weeks. As the White House pushed very hard to have a bill that the president could take to the G8 that summer and say, here's what we have done. What will you do? Now, what else was going on during that time? After the House had reported its bill, the HERC committee had reported its bill in April, there was a small team in the Senate, White House and a number of staff, working off the House committee language, thinking, what will work here? We got diverted a little while because the White House had its own ideas about what was needed legislatively to do what the president proposed to do, which was a fairly small, thin bill that we wasted a couple of weeks, frankly, persuading them that wouldn't work, that wouldn't fly. And then we began working on negotiating changes to this House language that we assumed was going to pass the House. When the bill got to the floor, that's where this particular earmark got added. Congressman Pitts proposed and succeeded in getting that change in a pretty close, largely partisan vote. The only earmark that went to the floor was that 55% must be spent on treatment in 2006 to 2008. That was in the bill. This abstinence earmark got added on the floor of the House. Did the 55% earmark make sense? Who knows? That'll be another study for you guys to look at, I'm sure, down the road. It's not clear that it did make sense. There's a footnote in this report that says the 55% treatment earmark is a bigger problem than the abstinence earmark. And remember, when the 55% earmark occurred, we hadn't yet got these major reductions in the cost of drugs. We didn't have the combined pill therapies. The thought was, while we want results, The best way to get measurable results is getting people on treatment. Treatment's expensive. Let's be sure we put a large chunk of dough into treatment. And who knows, it probably was not helpful in retrospect that earmark was even in there, because it invited the thought that there could be another earmark. And you'll remember that there was an earmark added by Congresswoman McCollum that 10% of the funds in 2006 and 7 and 8 had to be spent on orphans. And then Mr. Pitts came in after that with his abstinence earmark. I think that we on the Senate side always thought, and I was recently looking back at the House debate, and it didn't change my mind on this, that this whole debate centered of creating an earmark for abstinence centered on a desire to be sure that the A, if you will, of ABC got its due. And if you think of it in a crude sense, if A and B and C are supposed to be equal, but if you don't trust the folks at USAID to spend an equal share on A, then force them to. Nobody, I think, at the time was thinking in the context of PMTCT, IDU prevention, MSM prevention, half and half. I think it was, gee, ABC is our model. Let's make sure that a third of it is spent on abstinence. And even Chairman Hyde supported the amendment. It's interesting to look back at the debate. There were a few folks who felt quite strongly about it. Even the Washington Times, the day or the day before that issue was considered on the House floor, editorialized against it, saying these are decisions that are probably best made in the field. Now, it's kind of interesting to reflect just for a second on where the concerns about abstinence came from. In the 1980s, when USAID began to realize the scope of the problem in Africa, it started to gear up quickly and big time with a condom promotion program. The experts didn't see that as an effective solution or a long-term solution. The thought was it would buy time until we had the vaccine, which back in the 80s we thought was only a few years away. So how do we do something? How do we buy time till that vaccine comes out? And what do we do when we don't have a lot of money, we don't have a lot of expertise, we don't have a lot of people in the fields? Buy condoms, ship them out, use literature that's available, or adapt literature that's available from all the family planning activity that was going on. So there was this limited amount of time. There was a lot of emphasis on family planning, which was an AID priority. Here was a chance to get a dual benefit: some help on AIDS and some additional work in family planning, kind of a twofer. We didn't think that people would change their behavior all that much, and we're getting a note here probably telling me to hurry up. I'll try to speed this up here. There was a lot of hesitation and a lack of willingness to believe that we could actually cause people to change their behavior. And I think that as the experience in Uganda and elsewhere came to the fore, that's where some of the social conservatives got really distressed, that, darn it, our condom-focused program is a failure. You actually can convince people to change their behavior. There was a lot of noise around that issue at the time, and they became further emboldened, passed this amendment in the House. When it occurred, I think there was also a view, as is often the case in the Congress, that pass something now, go ahead and accept it, we'll fix it in conference. That was the expectation, and that's the path that we were all on. And then the Senate found itself in early May, time constraints, White House pushing to get the bill done. The question, can we negotiate some changes that the House will accept, that will clean up this issue, not eliminate an abstinence requirement necessarily, but modify it, give more flexibility to the field? Or do we need to pass the House bill in its current form? Well, there were a couple of things that happened. The White House said, we can live with this. Some senior people at AID said, we can live with this. Greatly complicating the argument that we need to fix this stuff or we're going to be ruining the day down the road. And it was up to the leader. It was up to the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Lugar, who, remember, was just a few months into the job. He had been deferring to Senator Frist and others most of the work on AIDS. And the judgment was made, too risky to not enough time to work this out, not enough time to go through a full-blown activity on the floor. Let's pass the House bill. The White House wants it. AID can live with it and see what happens. So you'll recall that on the floor of the Senate, all the amendments to change this and other provisions were beaten down, and the bill went forward. Now we're learning more and more about what we were left with. Lots of ways to fix this. But again, I come back to the recommendations in the report, which I found rather soft. Not urgent, not conclusive, partly to some extent dealing with the challenges of the data. And I'm thinking that whatever one's point of view on this issue, you can find some support in the report. I don't see in it, in its current form, a huge push to allow more flexibility at the moment. I think OGAC is going to have to reach the conclusion that it needs more flexibility. I don't see it saying that. And I'm sorry for going on, but I thought it might help to have that extra perspective. And now I will get out of the way, let you field your questions. And if somebody directs a question to me, I will be brief in my response.
Thank you. That's, I think, an important history for us all to have in our heads as we consider where we are now. And why don't we take a few questions, and you don't have to come up here to ask your question unless you want to. But we'll take a few questions, and then we can have a discussion about those. So, Janet. And just identify yourself, please.
Behind you. Hi, my name is Janet Fleischman. I chair the Gender Committee of the AIDS Task Force out of CSIS. And there's two issues I would like Dr. Gutnick to address. One is what I thought was a very interesting and important point that the report made, which involved the effect on PMTCT programs, and that the overall effect of this earmark was that other important prevention programs were squeezed. And again, this was related to some of the countries that had been exempted from the earmark so that others had to make up for the difference. And what you found, I believe, was that some very important programs, including PMTCT programs, had to be reduced in order to meet the requirements of the earmark. And I wonder if you could address that. And linked also to these sort of efforts at looking at what are the local needs, certainly on all my visits to PEPFAR countries, I hear a lot about the problems of ABC, and in fact, let me just use the most recent example. I was just in Uganda last week, and Canon Gideon, who was the first publicly positive HIV, the first publicly individual priest.
You say it really fast.
Yeah, right. Somehow it's a tongue twister. I asked him how he would describe the ABC experience in Uganda, especially relating to women and girls, and what he would say, given the situation in the U.S., to conservative legislators here and to President Bush. And he gave an extraordinary response, I thought, which basically said, ABC is actually the end point. It's not the beginning, and the U.S. is designing its programs backwards, because when you get to the point that women and girls can choose A, B, or C, you've made a lot of progress. But the realities of the epidemic are such that that's actually not the beginning, that's the end point. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about what the country team said about the local needs that they're not able to address.
Okay. Well, can we take a couple more, and then is that okay?
Thank you. Princeton Lyman, Council on Foreign Relations. I find one of the recommendations a little problematical, and that is you're asking OGAC to consult with the missions and then pass on that information to the Congress. I don't think that's a very realistic process. First of all, for them to have an honest discussion, and then for those missions to feel they can do so honestly, and for OGAC to pass it on, where you're asking them to put internal conversations out to the Congress. And I wonder if you've thought about whether that's an effective way to get an evaluation by OGAC and then a discussion with the Congress.
George Moose, George Washington University. First, let me thank Alan for his historical footnote here, because I think it is important to have that history, and because it sort of sketches the landscape of where the minefields are and where those who would wish to get more flexibility in the legislation are going to have to be working. But I wanted to pick up on a point that he made, and I put the point to David, and the question is this. What you looked at was the impact of the funding restrictions on the ability of country teams to design programs that they regarded as being effective. But correct me if I'm wrong, the study did not really examine the further question, which sort of relates to Janet's, which is how effective really are the programs that we are designing in actually doing what was intended, namely changing behavior in ways that would result in lowering infection rates, prevention. So if you would address that part of it, and if I understand correctly, if that's not in the report, then do you have some observations outside the report that address that question? Thanks.
I've been allowed to take those three. I'm not sure I can handle more than three at once. First of all, as a pretext, let me actually say I appreciate your comments, Alan. I do think that while GAO can't say all that bad or not all that bad, I'm not sure those are words that could come out of my mouth in an official capacity. I do think that you're correct in citing that the report uses some cautious language in the way that it frames the finding, and I think that is in our effort to be true to the observations that we brought in the hopefully candid views from the field. Let me take each of the three in order. On what happened to PMTCT, I think in part it's impossible to speak to the counterfactual, because we don't know what would have happened to PMTCT absent the spending requirement. But that said, there are a couple things that the report identifies. I presented aggregate data, but we have data that's disaggregated on page 43 of the report that looks at the five prevention areas broken down by countries that received exemptions and countries that did not receive exemptions from the 33% spending requirement. You don't see a whole lot of difference in PMTCT between countries that received exemptions and those that didn't in terms of the raw dollar amount. And what you see is essentially level funding for PMTCT. You don't know what would have happened absent the spending requirement, but you, in a sense, see level funding. What I can tell you also is that in the database, you can see that in nine of the 15 focus countries, spending for PMTCT declined. May not have declined a lot, but it declined. And in six, it went up. So that's some information without specifically answering what happened or what would have happened to PMTCT. on Princeton's point on passing on from the field, I think that's a very interesting observation. How could OGAC pass these candid views from the field? I think if you look at our recommendation, I don't think that we're literally saying take those waiver memos, take those exemption memos, and hand them to Congress. I don't think we're saying we're not, but I think your observation about the problems that might engender with respect to candor and other things would certainly exist. The Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator passes a lot of information from the field to Congress already in its congressional notifications. It manages and shapes that information into something that is a fair and accurate representation of what they're hearing from the field, but doesn't literally transmit. And I think that's what we were trying to signal there. But I think your observation is a very interesting one. The question of what's effective and what's not out there. I think our report, two things. Number one, the Leadership Act asks the Institute of Medicine, gives them 3 years, and asks them to study what's effective and what's not across the Leadership Act, as prevention, treatment, care, other activities. and I know that they're busy working on answering those questions for you, so stay tuned. But I think in part there's that answer, that we felt that it was a sufficiently complex area where real outcome studies are limited. We cite the so-called consensus statement in The Lancet as an aspirational notion of what are most effective, and recognize and state in our background that there's considerable debate and disagreement about what are most effective. The other thing I would say is, if you look at our appendix 3, we say a little bit about how the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator is going to go about counting results. And this is one of our sort of technical annexes, where we observe that the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator has adopted a model where they will rely on the U.S. Census Bureau to essentially create some baselines. What is the Census Bureau believe would have happened absent all comers, all interventions from donor funds, and then what has happened, calculate the delta, and look at infections averted. We observe a couple things. One, OGAC is not trying to disaggregate PEPFAR from all funding. We're not saying at all that they should. And in fact, the third principle in the three ones might suggest that they shouldn't. But either way, they've determined that there's enough data limitations that they're not trying to tease out their results from other results. We also observe that the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator looked at in its models working group, looked at ways in which they could try to tease out their interventions and different interventions as to what would yield results. They worked with the Futures Group. They came up with a series of options that they could have employed that would have determined which programs yielded which results and which yielded which results on a cost-effectiveness basis. You'll see some interesting things deep in this annex about what that might have shown, but they ultimately determined there was enough data to go in that direction, so they chose not to.
Hi, my name is Healy Thompson. I'm with the Center for Health and Gender Equity, and I just had two basic questions about the report. The first is, can you tell us which countries received the exemptions? And the second is, you did the 15 focus countries, and then you requested information from the 5 additional, and if I'm correct, 2 of those countries gave you information. And then at one point in the report, you refer to 17 of 20 countries. Is that those 15 plus those 2 that gave you information? And if so, would it be 17 of the 17 that responded, or were there the 3 countries gave you different information? Does that make sense?
Some of it does.
Okay.
I may have to turn to Celia for some of the answers to some of those questions.
Can we take one? There's
a hand right over there. Yeah, I have a related question, as long as this one's already on the table, and it relates to the issue of exemptions. And when you were presenting, you talked about, you come in as something to the effect that OGAC, I think you said, discourage the largest programs from requesting waivers. And then, you know, on one of the pages in the report, there's a similar statement that says, talked about a target, if OGAC had allowed many of the country teams with the largest amounts of funding to submit exemptions. That seems to imply that countries were told whether they could submit an exemption request or not. Can you comment on that when you talk about the exemption issue?
Can I do those two? Celia, help me find the actual citation in the report. What the guidance from the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator is variously, I want to actually quote our report as to how we framed it, because ultimately we came to a common understanding with the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator. But they discouraged countries who had a total of $75 million or more in PEPFAR funds from submitting requests for an exemption. And they also issued some guidance about extreme caution in submitting an exemption in the setting of a generalized epidemic. So he was going to find exactly where we said that in the report. But those were the parameters. Variously, and I want to actually use our own language so I don't misspeak, but variously considered to be permission to seek a waiver or just guidance on whether it was advisable to submit a waiver. I want to be clear on that. In terms of which countries received exemptions and which didn't, that is a matter of those exemptions have been granted, and thus that's a matter of public record. Does anybody want to correct me before I speak? Now, again, in order to encourage candor, the ground rules for our structured interview was we would not say this point observation came from Botswana, this one came from Nigeria, this one came from Uganda. However, now that the exemptions have been granted and actually the notifications have gone to Congress, I'm not aware of any limitations on saying which countries received. Is anybody from OGAC here? I'm happy to speak to who they are. I'm not aware of any restrictions on stating who they are. Maybe I should ensure. Is there anybody here from OGAC? Any problems with stating the countries that received exemptions? I'm not aware that there are. I'll tell you what, I'm happy to hold off on that, establish a common understanding with OGAC about whether that's public information and then get it back to the CSIS. I don't want to put something out there that is disclosing that information if it is not in the public domain at this point.
David, on page 30, the sort of second paragraph, page 3, basically what you said, allows justifications, but cautions that a very strong justification is required for not meeting the 66% policy, and they especially expect teams with total funding exceeding $75 million to meet the spending requirement.
Right. Top of page 30 is where you'd see our specific language agreed upon with OGAC as to how they framed that $75 million question of who could submit a request for exemption in the setting of large countries and countries with generalized epidemics. I think we just want to stand by those the way we framed it there.
Is that, you know, the math is a significant factor to take into consideration here. You can't give exemptions to a lot of countries, including ones with large budgets, and meet an overall average goal. So to the degree that I think OGAC has been candid that a large budget, the size of the budget, is a factor that is considered in the country decisions. Now, what role that size of the budget played is OGAC's to say.
I wanted, David, I just wanted to share some reactions to listening to what you said and reading the report over last night. I mean, the one impression is that I think the problem that you've tried to disaggregate is actually a little bigger than what you might take away from a kind of clinical reading of the report. And I'll explain what I mean by that. But what you're capturing is behavior at sort of the delivery end of what begins at a policy at Congress and gets filtered through various mechanisms. And then you're sort of asking, when you get to that face, that implementation face, are there problems there? And it begins with earmarks that, as Alan pointed out, were a function of expedience and mistrust. At the implementing end, what you see in terms of behavior is very little discussion of what about your real objectives are, but rather a convolution of effort and a lot of confusion and a lot of competition among objectives, sub-objectives, when there shouldn't necessarily be intensified competition, because everyone says, these are all mutually legitimate objectives, and in fact there's more than just ABC. There's three or four other prevention objectives that are part of this pool, but the way this earmark's been written, you have this false and very unnatural confinement of everyone into one space. And okay, you can say when this was done in 2003, it was done out of expedience and mistrust with the hope that maybe circumstances would relax. Well, what happened in the meantime was the antagonisms and polarization intensified. They didn't relax, they intensified. So the pressures upon your missions, and OGAC, I think there's plenty of evidence in your report that OGAC was struggling to through the exemptions and other things, struggling to in a balancing act way to give more flexibility where maybe there wasn't more flexibility in the way the law was written, so that people could make adjustments. But when you look at what happened at the implementing phase, you have a picture of missions that are operating under a lot of anxiety and confusion. They're trying to read the tea leaves and second guess. They have a sense of vulnerability, and they're rushing to decision points. And you're kind of documenting, okay, PMTC begins to get short shrift, or in certain non-exempted countries, condom monies are dropping, and how do you make sense of what this is? Those missions are making – we've seen this similar pattern of behavior in the missions that we've done to Ethiopia, Nigeria, and Vietnam. It's a similar pattern of people trying to make decisions under a weight of sense of vulnerability and confusion, and looking at two or three different sources of guidance to decide how to make decisions, which gets to sort of, okay, so what? What do you, what's the fix here? And I agree with what Princeton said, that the fix comes at Congress, and the fix comes through a bigger set of messages, and your work is very helpful in that. But first of all, you need a much bigger definition of prevention. ABC is too confining, it seems to me. I mean, even in the way that it's structured, it's only half of the story, and we're forcing people into these little compartmented, and the missions there has to be some message of empowering the missions to be able to make decisions with sufficient sense of what the local realities are, because they're having to sacrifice their response to local realities against trying to read the tea leaves of what's coming out of Washington, and that's where we're seeing bad decisions being made in some of these places.
I just wanted to add one comment and then ask a question. The comment was just to add one little fillip on the legislative history, that after the Global AIDS Act passed, and as Alan said, there was no opportunity to amend it in the Senate, or let alone have a conference about this provision or any other, Senator Feinstein did attempt to give OGAC more flexibility around this very earmark when the Foreign Aid Appropriations Bill went before the Senate later in the fall of 2003. And one of the things that she tried to do was to say that earmark, the one-third of all prevention money for absence until marriage, only needed to apply to that part of the money that was for preventing the sexual transmission of HIV, which is ultimately the way OGAC has come to try to interpret it on its own. At that time, Randall Tobias had just been confirmed as the ambassador, and he wrote a letter to the Senate opposing that, did not want that flexibility. So that's also an important part of the history to keep in mind. Why OGAC would not want that flexibility is a little beyond me, but nonetheless, that's part of the record. She is going to come back fairly soon and try that again in response to your report, because I think your report makes very clear that would relieve some of the funding pressures that this earmark, which is entirely arbitrary, as Alan said, came about. I was also involved at the time that it was invented. And honestly, it was invented because Congressman Pitts thought that all prevention of HIV was tantamount to an ABC program, and that A was one of three letters, and therefore we should devote one-third of the money to A. And that is literally how this earmark came about. So I guess I'm sorry to go on for my comment, but I thought that was important also to extend the record a bit. I did want to ask, since this report was requested by Chairman Henry Hyde, who has one notion of this program and what it should be and whether it should be, and Congressman Henry Waxman, who has, I dare say, an opposite notion. But Chairman Hyde is the chairman of the House International Relations Committee, and his Vice Chairman Congressman Smith is also very interested in this topic. I'm just wondering, since they're the ones who have the power to hold a hearing, to invite you up to discuss this and its implications, as they prepare to consider the reauthorization of the AIDS Act in a couple of years, Are they going to, what is your sense of how they're going to use the information you provided and whether they're seriously going to review it and apply it?
First thing to say is acknowledging that we had a letter from Chairman Hyde and a letter from Ranking Member Waxman in his capacity on government reform, we took and did this work independently of those two requests. We did this work under the CG's authority in order to impart on the recognition of the broad base of interest in Congress on this issue, and that Mr. Hyde and Mr. Waxman's letters represented not only their own interests but a much broader interest, and thus the basis upon which we did this work under CG's authority. Iraq work, Katrina work, some aspects of avian flu, for example, are the kinds of work that GAO will do under CG authority, so that it's not kind of a sort of an ownership relationship with a specific member or a specific committee. So we thought we could get a more objective frame on this by doing this under CG authority. In terms of how the House International Relations Committee will handle this information, manage this information, we have worked pretty closely with the House International Relations Committee, the minority as well as the majority. I'm sure know, our agency protocols call for drafts to be provided to them as the draft goes to the agency for their comment, and the letter in the back that reflects OGAC's comments. Again, the House International Relations Committee, as well as Mr. Waxman, as well as other members of committees with jurisdiction, saw this letter and had the opportunity to provide us with their thoughts and their issues and their concerns. They don't get a rebuttal the way the agency does, but they certainly are in a dialogue with us. And we're continuing to work with them in that dialogue. I wouldn't want to speak for them as to how they will ultimately use this work, but they're certainly aware of it.
Ray Copson, writing independently on African affairs these days. I find in talking with students and Europeans as well, it's commonly believed that the requirement is that one-third of our entire program is devoted to abstinence until marriage. And when I try to explain that it's only one-third to 20%, I'm met with disbelief. So there's been a public relations problem with this earmark that I don't think we're over yet. But my question is, you know, one repeatedly hears, and I have no firsthand information on this, of course, that country teams are afraid to come forward with programs focused on condoms because this earmark and the general political atmosphere make it clear that policymakers are hostile to condoms. And I wondered if this report is evidence that maybe the situation isn't that bad.
Thanks. I wanted to follow up a bit on Steve's remark, and it relates to yours as well now. David, your report talks about the impact of the funding restrictions and the way that has distorted the program structures of various countries. But I'm wondering if there isn't, beyond the simple funding restrictions, if the funding restrictions don't also have sort of, if you will, secondary and tertiary impacts as well that further distort. I noted on page 18 you talk about the fact that country teams try to select different partners to do different parts of their pieces of their programming. Well, if your goal is to have a coherent and integrated program, to what extent does that effort, that sort of breaking your programs into pieces, how does that affect the coherence and the integration of your programming and therefore the effectiveness of it? And the third part of it is the messaging. Related to that, if indeed you've got different partners who are emphasizing different aspects of the program or the problem, to what extent does that further create problems for how you integrate, how you create a coherent strategy at country level for dealing with the epidemiology of your particular country? Just curious as to what your thoughts would be.
And actually, I want to add one thing to that, which is more of an observation, and one that motivated us to have the discussion in December on the ABC guidance. I think one of the challenges, not specific to PEPFAR, but it's playing out in the context of PEPFAR, is what the guidance says and then how it's interpreted and how it's meant to be interpreted. And there is anecdotal information that is based on lack of clarity. You've heard this on the missions. And when we talked to OGAC, for example, about that last year on the ABC guidance, the response was, that's not the intention. That's actually not what the guidance says. And so we had the session here to actually talk about the guidance and what does the guidance say and what the parameters really are. And I think it's representative of these challenges of you set an earmark over here, whether how that was set is one whole issue, and then how it gets interpreted by the agency and then translated to the field. There's the literal translation and then the perception. And to add to Steve's putting this in perspective of that train there and that relationship, we also, have to remember in the history that this was very high profile at the time and a lot more money relative to what had been the past quickly. Also combined with, on the prevention side, still, we hear all the discussion about what really works and what is the right intervention, despite evidence that is published in many, many places. But I think that's indicative of two things. One, the challenges of understanding prevention, and the other is that we have very few national-level examples of scaled-up interventions that have been scaled up to a country level for sufficient time to allow us to say, this is what we can do. So all of those are just by way of saying that I think what your findings to some extent are showing that the translation, part of it's the funding literally, but part of it is also how to interpret all these things and what level, and the agency struggling with that as well as the field.
Well, let me just make a quick comment because I don't have any answers to the questions except to say that I think it's an excellent question. If I understand it, the question to be, at least over here, the extent to which the funding requirements are driving integration or lack of integration at a programming level. I don't know that our report captured that specifically. I don't know that I feel like I'm the most competent person in the room to answer that question, but I think it's a worthy one of discussion. I think to Ray's point that, which is a little related to Alan's, which is the report really saying it's not all that bad? I think not all that bad is a value judgment. Again, I'm not prepared to say, but I think that is a fair reading, not only of the report, but I think a balanced view of what we heard candidly from the U.S. government teams in the 15 focus countries in particular was a great deal of support for the activities they were getting from the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator here in Washington. And I think there was some recognition, while not captured in the scope of the challenges to the implementation of the sexual prevention strategy, which was our lens, but there was a tenor in the response that evidenced a great deal of support, not universal, but support for the work that was being done on their behalf by the Global AIDS Coordinator. I think one point, while not made by the respondents to our U.S. government respondents, but a point I'd like to leave here having made, is that if you look at this program, one of its principles is to respond with urgency to the crisis. If you look at the rate at which OGAC obligates and expends its money, in some ways it's extraordinary. If you were to compare this to another development assistance program, if you were to compare this to a lot of other efforts and recognize that they have no-year funds, but their database shows that they are obligating essentially all of their money in the year in which it is appropriated, and that they are instructing the field to spend that money within 12 months of receiving it. We don't have data, and their database does not capture their rate of spending, but it does capture the rate of obligation. It suggests a fairly extraordinary pace that is consistent with the sense of urgency. That's not saying the programs are the right programs, integrated or not integrated, but it is saying that they are able to move resources into programs at a rate that probably by comparison to many other development assistance efforts is a strong track record.
Mary Lynn Fielding-Gare with JSI. Thank you for the report. This is a comment a little more to CSIS probably. If you look at HIV/AIDS from the point of view of a minister of health or a country. I think, in fact, the U.S. is a huge player at the table, but there's multiple players. And I don't know whether people in the field spoke about it, but if you were going to be strategic as a country team, you would look at what other players, what Global Fund was doing, what DFID was doing, what the ministry was doing, and then complement that with your strategy as to how much you needed in prevention versus PMTCT versus treatment based on what the total basket looks like in the country. Unfortunately, with earmarks, you really don't do that very well. We used to do that with prevention programs. When I was working on prevention back in 92, 93, through those few years, when people say prevention doesn't work, it's really a frightening statement. We worked with national level governments to use $500,000 to figure out how to cover an entire country. And the lesson that's been lost, and I think the basis of my question is, who is now doing this analysis? There's going to be no more centrally funded projects that will do behavioral research, operations research, that we know of on the horizon as implementers for years, to actually analyze what works and what's effective. It's the questions we used to ask are not ABC, but the combination of behavior change communications, STI prevention and treatment, policy-level contextual interventions, and condom social marketing at that time. And to the extent that we learned that to the extent that you could have all of those targeted to a population intensively over a consistent long period of time, then you could be effective. There's graphs in the old days that showed, do one, you get this level of effect, do two, you get this level, do all, and you get that level. Those lessons are lost these days. You don't even hear them talked about anymore. So there's another level to go to, and I guess my question is, who is doing that level of analysis, think tank work, behavioral research, that the global community can benefit from? The U.S. used to be bringing that to the table. It's not that I'm in favor of lots of money for research, but the prevailing assumption these days is, we know what to do now, let's just go and do it. There's some benefits to that perspective, but I think we're also losing something in the process.
I actually don't have data to say what is, you know, the comparative to before, who is sponsoring operational research or field research, but I do know that OGAC has expressed and some reports that a CSIS has put out is the importance of operational research and the constraints around how much can go for operational research or how much should go is a question. But I think there is still research. I mean, some of the research that's been coming out in The Lancet recently, some of it's been USAID researchers, UNAIDS, et cetera. So I think there's still research going on, but I do agree that the opportunity to learn so much from what's happening, particularly in focus countries, since so much program implementation has gone on, is really critical. I don't know if somebody from OGAC wants to talk about some of the operational research that might be underway. And I don't know to what extent the IOM is looking at this, but...
Well, I think there is operational research occurring at two levels. There's operational research occurring centrally, which is usually across multiple countries, and then there's operational research occurring within the country operational plans. And I think that we're about to have a large meeting in Durban, and having just read all the abstracts last night, some of you may have got your announcements this morning, I think you're going to see some very interesting work. I think what it looks like when you sort of start thinking about country plans is that there's little pieces of data. But what's emerging are common themes that I think are going to have some very important results that will address some of these issues that we addressed before, maybe in the same way, but we called it large central funding. But now they're being addressed with more funding through country operational plans in addition to these centralized. So I, having been part of the same process that you were many years ago, Mary Lynn, I share your concerns. But having seen the results that are coming from these countries and understanding that there are basic themes that must be addressed in different programs that are that have been designed to address sort of the important issues in prevention, treatment, and care. I think we are going to have some answers to those and find some other questions that we need to address.
David, do you want to say anything, have the last word?
Well, I'd like to make just a quick comment on the point that was made, because I think another way in which OGAC is taking some real steps forward is that through their country operational plans and through the database that they've set up, while it's a much greater challenge, order of magnitude greater challenge, to be looking at outcomes research, they are able, I think, with a high degree of accuracy and reasonably effective fashion, to count their outputs. They are doing a pretty extraordinary job. They reported out in their annual report. We were privileged to have access to the source data that was the basis for that annual report. Again, without any statement that it's the right outputs or the wrong outputs, their ability to measure outputs is pretty extraordinary, and it has to do with the centralized planning. Sometimes there's some griping from the field about the reporting burdens that are the basis of that centralized planning. We heard some of that. We didn't think it rose to the level of a finding in this report, per se, but the reporting burden on the downside, but on the upside, their ability to collect and measure what they do is pretty extraordinary and would ultimately form the basis of some outcomes research. It isn't outcomes research.
David, can I make one little clarification there? When you say giving advice to the level of finding, I want to make sure that to clarify that, you know, comments from the field about reporting burdens and the centrally managed aspect of OGAC, you know, were important. But a number of field staff acknowledged that with so much new funding and programs and rules rolling out so quickly, that part of that reporting burden, you know, might be working itself out. And so the question was, is there, you know, a conclusion we want to draw, a recommendation for a particular policy change, and that did not wind up being a key focus. But if anyone from the field heard this, I mean, to the degree that the country teams were working just incredible hours to try to get up to sort of the initial starting point and expectations with regard to those burdens, that was certainly true.
David, it's very clear that you brought all that experience taking care of all those Peace Corps volunteers' medical status for 8 years across the globe to this task. Just personally, thank you very much, and both of you for coming and doing this. Do you want to have the last word?
Just want to thank David and his team for being willing to come and talk about this. And when we first approached GAO a year ago about the study, and then a few months ago about the report, we had no idea what any findings. I mean, GAO is very, very quiet and does the work in a very objective way. So we really didn't know what the report would say, but we knew that it would be an important discussion to have because of the way it was being conducted, and that it would be one of the first reports on prevention. So we're very happy that this worked out to have this today, and look forward to further sessions. You'll see some of them outlined on what we've handed out, but really appreciate everyone coming and spending some time inside to talk about this important issue, but on a very nice day. So thank you.